everybody, and welcome to Tapped Into Psychedelics. I'm your host, Adam Tapp, and with me is my friend and producer, Handsome Jason. Today's interview will be the second part of our February of Sexuality. And with us is Dr. Leah Janine. How are you doing, Leah?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
So Leah is a doctor. She's also a co-founder of Intium, and she also hosts Sex Talk with Dr. Leah, which you can find on YouTube. It's on PBS. It's actually really super interesting. And I first saw and met Janine in Florida, in Miami, at the psychedelic conference, and you were talking on a platform, you're talking about female sexuality, you're talking about the company that you co-founded. And it actually sort of inspired me to do this whole thing on human sexuality, because I think it's profoundly important. And so do you want to tell us just a little bit about the company Intium and a little bit about Sex Talk, perhaps?
Yeah, absolutely. So, initially I got into the field because I did my undergrad in public health and then my master's in sports science. And so I thought, you know, I got great advice when someone said, when you're doing your dissertation, find something you're not going to be bored with in 4 years. And I was like, sex. Great. That sounds wonderful. So I got into really researching sexual behavior in my dissertation. And then from there, I got a lot of research opportunities. I was asked to be a guest on some of the PBS shows, and I discussed a wide variety of topics, supplementation, creatine, veganism, everything related to health and exercise. And one of the topics was on sexual health. And of course, that always seems to be what people find the most interesting. And so after I filmed 6 episodes as a guest, they invited me to have my own show, Sex Talk with Dr. Leah, which has been lots of fun, way more fun than I expected it to be. And the most recent season, I have a co-host. And so it has a little more of a lighthearted feel. Initially, it was just me spitting research. But season 2 is a lot more exciting, as well as season 3. And then I was doing a presentation at a neuroscience conference. It was either neuroscience or sports supplements, because I attend them all the time. And I was approached by somebody at Intium, which is a sexual wellness company, really focusing on intimacy. And they're really looking into launching MDMA with another proprietary ingredient, and launching it into the market as soon as we can. Obviously, that's largely based on the FDA and waiting for all those things. And Florida might be a little bit of a while, but that's what we're hoping for.
See, and it's funny that the last conversation I had with ZG, we know we were getting kind of into this idea of human sexuality and how deeply important it is to us as individuals, as groups and couples. You know, I have this thought, and I can't escape from it, is that, you know, we are deeply sexual beings, both genetically, biologically, and one could argue very successfully that pretty much every motivating factor that we engage in on a day-to-day basis is somehow entangled with our sexuality, but yet we are stuck living in a culture of taboo and stigma, and no one can seemingly have a conversation about this without people giggling or having it censored.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. It's interesting because when I've been introduced by other professors, and I mean, these are people who have degrees in health science, and we'd study everything about the body. Whenever they'll talk about any of my sexual research, they've told me later they feel embarrassed just even mentioning the title. And I'm like, you're an adult. Why is this so challenging for you?
And part of it, I think, and that this was a conversation that we have, that we kind of live in a theocracy. You know, our society is fundamentally based around older religious belief structures and the ideas of modesty and shame and all these different things. And I think that really dangerously impacts people. I think the ideas of associating shame with sexuality is very negative, but also I think that, you know, half of our population are women and that they have this significant increase in stigma associated with sexuality. And I think that that's something that you sort of focus on. And I know that when you were talking at the conference, one thing that I thought was really interesting that I'd never even thought of before is that there are a plethora of different medications for male sexual dysfunction, but there's like a handful of super inconvenient ones for women. Like, do you have any input on that?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I've got a lot of those. So first, I'll even back up. You made an initial point talking about the stigma with women. And I actually am really against the way sex education is run in the United States. because it is 37 states require sex education to be taught in schools, but only 13 states require it to be medically accurate. Okay. So,
so you can just make shit up the entire, that's
right. So exactly. Exactly. So then, well, and it really is like that. So we know HIV is a virus. Virus is smaller than, you know, a virus technically could go through the pores of a condom. Technically a virus could, but obviously it's traveling in a fluid that cannot, right? And so they would teach in Tennessee, a condom does not protect against HIV because a virus is smaller than a condom. That's what they taught. This was a while ago, but I mean, this was at least when I was in college. So it wasn't that long ago. They felt comfortable teaching that. And that's just really shocking. And so they thought it would deter people from having sex.
They're just talking about sex with condoms. Yeah. Like, yeah, that's what I took from that. I'm like, condoms are for losers. You know, like,
right. And we all know that isn't true. I mean, there's tons of research that shows where one partner is HIV positive and the other remains negative. And even before all the medications that have really come out, particularly in the gay community, but a lot of medications, condoms were the only thing you had, and it did help prevent HIV. So it really is, it's so detrimental to have those types of education. The other problem is with education is that even the ones that are considered more medically accurate, all they do is teach, sex, you can get an STD, you can get pregnant, and they teach you how to prevent those things, but it's never coming from a sex positive light. And, you know, in the United States, we've even cut a lot of the comprehensive education, which we call it, which is telling people how to protect themselves. And a lot of that has been cut recently, which, you know, the ongoing joke is, how do you spend this much money telling people to be abstinent? Like, you're just poking holes in condoms. Like, I understand why you spend money giving people like condoms and lubrications and things that would help. But of course, the most painful part is it doesn't work. Right. So on that one, there are, and a disclaimer, I actually went to Catholic high school, so I'll say that, but my mom would need me to say that. But the reality is, in Catholic education, you know, you're really against sex before marriage. And the reality is, when we use those educational programs, it does delay sex for about 8 months. But again, once people then have sex, they're less likely to use condoms, or they engage in anal sex or other things that are actually a little bit more dangerous in terms of spreading diseases. So that also drives me nuts. But again, back to the women. Interestingly enough, there was a study that found that when women don't use condoms, I would think it'd be lack of access or just not convenience. But in reality, it was that they didn't want to be stigmatized for being promiscuous, because it was less bad to engage in random sex, like, oh, I was drunk and it just happened. Whereas if a woman carried a condom,
that it shows premeditated behavior for something. Yeah, that's
right.
But that also kind of speaks to some other things with regards to sex health and STD and prevention. It's always kind of forced upon being the female's responsibility, right? Like, birth control needs to be taken ahead of time. If a man doesn't have a condom as a backup, you know, women should have condoms on their person. But then, you know, the caveat is that if they have condoms and it seems like, you know, they might be promiscuous. And unfortunately, it's kind of just really feeding into what you're talking about.
Absolutely. I had a guy friend of mine, this is a while ago, I was laughing, but he was talking to another guy friend of mine and talking about how promiscuous some girl was in a negative light. And he was saying, because, hey, I mean, she slept with me without a condom. I'm like, bro, you also slept with her.
You participated in that transaction. What an interesting way to phrase that.
So I'm like, it's really, really shocking. And it is, it's just always the women that are stigmatized. Like, and you'll see it, and other countries are even far worse, because I've looked at sex education in all over the world, and some are really, really great. Brazil's really wonderful for their sex education. And which is interesting, because people think of Brazilians as inherently sexual, which may or may not be true, but their sex education really matches it. And so they're not spreading diseases at the same rates that we are. It's just consistently stigmatizing women and making sure that we are the ones responsible for that. And that's simply not the case, right? It shouldn't be that case, at least.
Well, yeah. And again, I think this stems back to an overarching sort of religious overtone to everything. You know, I think it's safe to say that Catholicism is fairly misogynistic. Just my opinion on that. And then that just translates into the view of women in society. And so do you think that as a culture, we're moving towards less of a stigma with sexuality, or do you think we're regressing some? Because it's...
Ooh, that's a tough one. I think as a culture, in some ways, we're more accepting. In some ways, I think that just in conversations that I've had with men and women, I think women are more open now. You look at like shows like Sex and the City that came out, gosh, 23-5 years ago, something like that, where women were able to say, you know, they were allowed to quote, the very first episode was, we can have sex like men, right? So, and I think that now that wouldn't really be that shocking. I think that people would be much more comfortable with that. So I think in some ways we are. I think that in other ways, especially in the state of Florida, we are really going the opposite way. You know, there's jokingly, they call it, I don't know if you're familiar, the Don't Say Gay Bill, but really, we can educate everybody about the stories that are in the Bible, which if you actually read them are very interesting. I don't want to offend anybody too much, but like we're talking about somebody in their late 20s who got a 14-year-old pregnant and it wasn't her choice and two angels. Like we could talk about that, but we can't say like Bobby has two dads. Like, come on, where are we going?
Well, right. And like, yeah, Santos and Florida and everything going on with that, it is sort of interesting to see the progression, how it's gone very, very red in the past little bit. Like, it used to be a swing state. I don't even know what happened. Now it's like just this red sea. And I think, again, that contributes that, you know, right wing does have a tendency to be a little bit more religious in the application of their policies.
I think you have to look at voter demographics.
Absolutely.
Too.
Well, yeah. Voter demographics, well, gerrymandering doesn't.
No, it does not. No, it's not.
That's another problem that we're struggling with. And I think a lot of Floridians become a little bit one issue candidate. So again, because of religion, there became a big, you know, pro-life movement. Obviously we see what happened there, Roe v. Wade being overturned. So another war on women. It really just depends. I've seen Florida go the opposite way in the last couple of years, and it's really, really sad. And same thing. And I will say this, you know, although it is typically more conservative ideals that are pushing abstinence-only education, the reality is abstinence-only education really got pushed a lot in the Clinton administration back then. The Obama administration went the other way and, you know, really opened it up. And then the Trump administration spent a lot of money again against abstinence-only or for abstinence-only education. So it's just sad to me that science again has to be politicized. Right? If it doesn't work, there we go.
Yeah, no, that's a pretty reasonable statement. So let's get back to Intium, because I think what you're doing there and what you want to do is amazing. And so, you know, we were talking about the ideas of women with sexuality, and we're talking about the fact that there's, you know, an amazing amount of medications to give a man an erection for up to 48 hours and so forth. But yeah, with women, like there's really isn't much. And now, do you think that stems from the fact that for men, sexual issues can easily be solved by simple dilation of vessels, whereas for women, it might be more, I think both sides are emotional in a lot of different senses, but it's easier to solve a male erectile dysfunction issue than it is to solve female arousal. Is that sort of a...
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, let's be real. If Viagra could come up, or, you know, if Pfizer could come up with a Viagra for women that actually worked that way, they would have done it. I mean, it was a hugely profitable drug, right? So they would have.
Sorry to interrupt. Did they not? I thought one of the crazy stories with regards to Pfizer and Viagra was that their patent was about to expire, and then they rebranded it as Levitra and sold it to women as a way of extending the patent.
Levitra is usually still towards men. The two drugs that are towards women are Addy and Valise.
Okay.
So, but they, so your patent, I believe, only lasts for 20 years. And then at that point, you know, you could do knockoff. So I'm not sure exactly what happened with them. And I know Viagra wasn't actually intended to be an erectile dysfunction.
No, it was an angina medication, wasn't it? It was, And all of a sudden these guys, you know, for chest pain start getting erections. And like, well, this is a pleasant side effect.
Hey, you know that they're making way more off it this way. Well, you know, and interestingly enough, I just read an article the other day that men who take Viagra actually end up living longer because they have lower rates of heart problems. So even people who didn't initially have angina or, you know, pain in your heart due to lack of blood flow to the heart are now actually living longer.
Yeah, a byproduct of having erections would probably be an absence of preload to the heart, which would cause less strain, which is...
Absolutely. So, I mean, it makes sense. It makes sense that these guys are living longer, but now that Viagra's been out for so long, we can really see it. But yeah, it is really sad. So, because obviously there is a more psychological component. There is a psychological component with women in having orgasms or wanting to have sex. And obviously there's a physiological component as well. But it's not as easy as let's give everybody a vasodilator and then then women are going to be great. And the reality is the majority of sexual dysfunctions are caused from some type of sexual trauma or some type of PTSD. And we tend to think, when you think PTSD, you think of guy in the military, right? Like, I think that's what everyone thinks of, that, like, let's solve his problems. But the reality is women are suffering at rates of depression, like twice the rates of men. And we're not really looking at that. Women also suffer from postpartum depression. And then you've got hormones and a baby. I mean, talk about sex life. I can imagine plummeting at that point. And just overall, women's sexual health is really underrepresented. It just is. A lot of times you're just going to look at male sexual health. I think part of it's societal. I think part of it's just where the money is. If a woman doesn't desire sex, you're like, oh, okay, it's her problem. But if a guy can't get an erection, it's like, oh God, wait, stop. We need to cover this. We need to be able to change this. So, you know, you're just really focusing on it. The other things are the side effects of Viagra really aren't that bad. Whereas the side effects of Addy, and again, same kind of things, low blood pressure, drinking alcohol, birth control, all of those things will affect. But like one of those you have to inject 45 minutes before intercourse. Like nothing seems less sexy than like, hey, let me go inject myself. And then hopefully in 45 minutes, I'm in the mood. Like that doesn't sound very fun, you know? And same things, there's only, don't quote me on this one. I think it's only like you could use it 8 times a month, or there's a lot of limits on these that you're doing. So there really needs to be something like these drugs are kind of like a patch, but they're not really curing the sexual dysfunctions. Whereas, you know, Viagra's curing erectile dysfunction for the most part, we're just kind of patching it and saying, well, maybe you'll get more desire, but we're not really curing it. Whereas if you're looking at the psychedelic space and you can cure the sexual trauma, or at least greatly alleviate it, then you might overall help over sexual health.
Which is sort of like a really interesting overlap. And one other thing too, I want to say is that, you know, you were talking about, you know, PTSD is viewed as this man in the military thing. And I completely 100% agree with that. And I think personally that everyone has some level of PTSD because being alive is hard. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's not as if, you know, that having PTSD is this defining point, but I think that everyone has these aspects of issues with their identity, with issues with their self and traumas, and both emotional and physical, that occur over your lifetime. And then it just really depends on coping mechanisms, if you've been taught them, if they're adequate enough, social environments, social support. And I think you're right. Like the fact that it's seemingly overviewed very significantly in female populations, and then that contributing to the emotional effects of having sort of sexual dysfunction. And so one thing I just wanted to ask you was that the two medications that you're talking about for female sexual dysfunction, how do they necessarily function? Like one, they're injectable, or at least one is. Like, is it?
Yeah, one's injectable and one is oral. And so it's supposed to cause you to be more. Let me just back up. In placebo-controlled trials, they didn't really work. So how they are working in terms of overall blood flow and the mechanics, the chemistry of it, I don't actually know. But I can say that in placebo-controlled trials, they do not work. Now, I'll back up, and this is why I think it's important, is that I've done research on MACA and sexual functioning, and it was placebo-controlled. And so if you just looked pre-test, post-test, it was significant. MACA cured all the sexual issues for men and women. It was wonderful. But once you compare it against the placebo, the difference was no longer significant in women, but it was in men, which obviously goes to show that with sexual functioning, women are really affected by the placebo effect.
Yeah.
The men were not really as much.
That's actually kind of interesting. And so second off, when we get back into India now, so what is the mechanism in which you want to use psychedelics to help improve sexuality for women, sexuality for men, just sort of what is the mechanism that makes this the company special?
Well, obviously, I think it's important for women, but it's also important for couples. So it may be the type of thing, and again, this really depends on the FDA. It may be the type of thing where a couple can take it together. Obviously, you're going to want them to have some privacy. So, I mean, I can't imagine anything less sexy than a therapist watching you. Like, that's
I'd be okay with that. Well, okay.
I think it depends. People with sexual issues probably don't want anybody else watching. For those of us that are lawyers, that are like, it might be a little bit different there. So, it really might vary. But MDMA really helps couples work through this by increasing vulnerability, also increasing pair bonding. It can stimulate libido, especially in women. Can help with some lubrication. And people on MDMA, and again, this is mainly anecdotal because we really can't research a lot of it here, but do report feeling more sexual and more sensual. And so the combination of MDMA plus this other active ingredient, it seems to be like a really perfect marriage. So we would love to get out there and have it reach. The other thing is a lot of, when we talked about it a little bit, obviously sexual issues largely stem from, past sexual trauma, but PTSD, as you said, I mean, that could be from, you know, excessive family values or, you know, guilt around sex. It could be related to a bunch of things. And MDMA, by allowing you to feel more free, it allows you to talk about maybe the really harsh family values or the guilt you feel about sex and really address the issues that are inhibiting overall sexual performance.
So, you know, I know that like MAPS has been doing considerable amounts of work on MDMA for a huge amount of time. And MDMA before as a party drug was actually a therapeutic drug. And so moving forward, like they're using that specifically for PTSD, but I can say, and you know, back in like the late 90s, you know, the rave scene was all the rage and, you know, I've done my share of MDMA and I can completely say that it makes you so profoundly empathetic. And, oh, yeah. And the amount of just love that you feel in that environment is almost indescribable. And so is the idea that you take an individual or a couple, they take MDMA in a controlled environment, and then they talk to each other under the guidance of a therapist, or like, how would it necessarily work?
Well, that would be ideal. Obviously the FDA and other regulatory entities have a big role in how it'll work. I know that MAPS has already said that they don't necessarily think that psychedelics will be a take-home drug. I know at any point in the near future, because obviously it's one thing if you're dealing with PTSD and you take a psychedelic and you're sitting in a therapist's office talking about it. It's another thing if you're dealing with a sexual issue and you're taking it. So having a take-home drug, especially in like even a microdose type form, could be really, really beneficial. But, you know, we're hoping that somebody could facilitate physical intimacy in a clinical setting. So where they could also be, you know, have the privacy and safety maintained there. But if it's not able to move forward in this, then it'll be more of a traditional, you know, psychedelic assisted psychotherapy model, which has been shown to help a lot of people in for PTSD.
So question is, right now, is there infrastructure in place so that, say, my wife and I are having some sort of problems, and can we go to a therapist and actually have sexual intercourse in said office? Like, does that infrastructure exist? Is that a barrier that you have to climb over, or is it more simply just adding MDMA into the situation itself?
Yeah, right now, I mean, that would be a huge barrier right now to have that. So yes, that is a barrier at this point.
I find that incredible, though. Like, everyone, you know, for our population to exist, sex has occurred, and I don't understand why, you know, sex itself is somehow frowned upon so significantly that it can't be done in a therapist office privacy. You know, that seems incredible to me.
Yeah, not that I know of. I have not heard of any legal way for that to occur there. And even when like a psychedelic assisted therapy, obviously the therapist has to protect themselves. So there, I do know of some instances where therapists have used that, but the person has to like take it on their own and then can come in. So it can't be something that therapists can find for them. They cannot be around the dosing. You know, it's still illegal to be giving that there. So,
well, and I think that works in a lot of things. Like, you see all these psychiatrists and psychologists who are doing integration work, but it's always, I can coach you on what to expect during the psychedelic experience and we can talk afterwards, but you have to source it yourself. You do it yourself in your own controlled environment, and then we'll come and have a conversation. And that seems to be the mechanism and how it's working right now, I imagine.
Yeah, and you know, there is reason for some concern, right? If somebody is impaired and somebody else is in a controlled position, like being a therapist, especially if the therapist is male and the person who is taking the substance is female. And there were some issues in the past with that, right? Their sessions weren't recorded. A lot of times it was only with one therapist. A lot of times women were there because they had gone through their own sexual trauma. And then now you're being traumatized again by your therapist. I mean, that's really not helpful. But I mean, there definitely needs to be, there are already laws in place for this. So sessions are recorded. Typically there are two therapists that are there. Sometimes one, sometimes male, sometimes female. You know, in the instance of having partner issues, you could bring your partner, or maybe even just bring somebody else along that you trust and that you feel comfortable with. There are other things that are set in place now in advance. So they have like what's called negotiating up versus negotiating down. So meaning if I come in there and I know that even with my partner, if I know that I do not want to have penetrative sex and maybe but you know, touching in certain ways are okay with me. But then when I'm under MDMA and then I'm feeling the love and I'm thinking it's great, the therapist will not allow you then. They'll say, you know, it's great that you're feeling you want to have sex, great that you are open to that. But when you were sober before you came in here, you said you didn't want to engage in that. So they will make sure that people don't negotiate up. On the other side, if I say coming in, I'm okay with penetrative sex and then I change my mind, you can negotiate down. So little things like that are really meant to keep, you know, everything really, really safe. And again, obviously these therapists are going to need to be trained in how to deal with difficult experiences that may arise when you're under the influence, like fear or confusion or whatever it may be. Maybe they, you know, therapists need to be trained in if the client is becoming too attached to the therapist. So, and additionally, these drugs really aren't all that dangerous, but there is a slight drop in blood pressure and hydration guidelines and things like that just need to be monitored throughout the session.
So out of curiosity, and I know this is like sort of a broad statement, it's very subjective, but so is what you want to do with NTM and the plan that you have, which I actually think is incredible, how easy is it to pull off? Because it does seem like there's a lot of barriers. And, you know, do you think in Florida specifically, is that where the company's based out of? Like, is that of Florida?
Yeah, the company's based out of Miami. I think that California, I mean, I think that Canada is going to be really, really helpful in terms of research. I mean, it looks like you guys are a little more progressive. So that I think would be incredibly important. I do think that it will be able to be pulled off. Obviously, it's not going to be approved for dealing with sexual dysfunctions right away. It's just not, because of all the stigmas around sex. The reality is it's going to be looked at as an antidepressant or looking at PTSD first. But much like marijuana, you know, it first became for cancer patients, and then it was like, you know, anyone with a headache had a script for marijuana. So I think it'll really go that way once the FDA approves it. And again, the company's really willing to pivot according to the law. So if it's something, you know, macro dosing, there's a great benefit in macro dosing, right? And the plan would only be to macro dose 3 to 4 times, because that's what MDMA has been approved for healthfully. So 3 or 4 times a year. So it would be a lot of sessions that you're having with your therapist, a couple of macro dosing sessions, and then also following up with your therapist. It's not just like, you know, take this drug and have fun. So that looks like that's going to be the model that would be approved first. Like I said, it would be wonderful if it were a take home drug. I just don't necessarily see that it's going to be that way at this point.
So do other psychedelics sort of fall into this category of sort of helping with sexual dysfunction? Like, I know that MAPS primarily uses MDMA. You guys are primarily using MDMA with another substance. And I'm not sure if that's works synergistically as another psychedelic or if that's just something else. And that's in, you know, your secret sauce, so to speak.
So psychedelics can help because obviously there is a connection there, but MDMA is really, I think, the best one when you're dealing with sexual issues, because it causes a really such a great amount of empathy for other people's, issues that they're dealing with. Also like oxytocin and things of that, where you really need that love, chemical. I really think MDMA is going to be the best way. Not to say that psychedelics as a whole wouldn't be beneficial, because they are beneficial for a wide range of other issues. But when we're talking about really getting a couple closer, I think MDMA is definitely the way to go. And ideally this would be something which couples can do together, and it could help a lot of their issues. But I do think it should be noted that you have to be cautious with it too, because I heard of somebody, I didn't know him personally, but he was actually in a really awful relationship. I believe she was kind of emotionally abusive. He really wanted it to work, did MDMA with her. I don't know what kind of counseling they had along with it, legally or not legally. But it did cause him to be a lot closer. And ultimately she wasn't the person he was supposed to be with. Right. So it does, you know, if this is not the person you need to be with. I think that you need to really evaluate that first, either through therapy or within yourself, and say, you know, maybe this person is an abusive psychopath and I don't want to be linked to them. Maybe I need to get out.
To be fair, that doesn't necessarily sound like a bad case scenario, because I've never heard of a relationship breakup or divorce ending because the relationship was happy. So, you know.
Yeah. Well, that is an interesting notion, though, is that by doing the MDMA therapy actually strengthen a destructive relationship, because I can totally see how that would happen too. You know, like,
yeah, because it encourages all the empathy and communication and openness, and all of those things are great. And I mean, let's be real, we all probably had some bad relationships in our days, yeah. Right? The person wasn't all bad. And when you would stop and you'd be like, oh God, they are being open and I do feel bad for them and I do love them. But like, ultimately, we weren't meant to be with them, right? Ultimately, we should have left. They still did have their psychopath tendencies that we needed to leave. So yeah, if you're having pair bonding with somebody that might not be the best person, or even worse, what if they held it against you later, any kind of manipulative way, that could be a problem.
But, and again, too, right? Like, psychedelics are a tool, and people always talk about, you know, that psychedelics, you can break people, or else you have the polar opposite of people refusing to acknowledge that there's pitfalls with things. And at the end of the day, you know what I mean? Like, the psychedelics are a tool that just have to be used in the appropriate circumstance. And sorry, you're saying something?
Oh, yeah. So I just wanted to ask a little bit, because I mean, I'm observing in the background here and just kind of making some inferences. I don't know if they're correct or not, but Dr. Leah, just with regards to MDMA, I'm curious about what your thoughts are in terms of the mechanism of action for effectiveness, because it sounds like, based on the previous studies that you were talking about, how the placebo effect was kind of matched in women with regards to the medications they were getting, but like, there was an actual statistically significant difference in men. Is that because it's like, men are based on arousal states that are more physical in nature, and women typically have to get over like mental hurdles or anxiety that kind of are these artificial barriers to sexual arousal, and the MDMA assists with that? Or is there something else that's kind of doing that? Just because I noticed that you mentioned oxytocin release and maybe some other endogenous chemicals. Can you speak a little bit more to that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I do think it is. I think the psychedelics are even more important in women for all the reasons I said prior, like we don't have any other really great options, but also simply because of the mental hurdles, right? So I don't think you're going to have a huge placebo effect with MDMA. You know when you're on MDMA or not, right? So that's not going to be quite the problem that it was with other drugs. But yeah, I do think a lot of it is the mental hurdles, right? I mean, it was, and what I tested was maca. So it is a supplement. It is not something you could feel immediately. It was a 28-day trial. So,
maca being like from the maca root.
From the maca root.
Gotcha.
And it was actually, and it's great for a lot of other purposes too, memory, mood. Interestingly enough, I found that it improves strength with only 28 days, which is, if you know anything about X-Fiz, it's really, really hard to improve strength in only 28 days. So I was very surprised by that. All of these things and men, women. Right?
Yeah.
Great for men. That is the study that I conducted. I can't speak for all other studies. But so I do think, obviously, there are so many mental barriers that women have. And I could say that in friendships that I've had, there were women that would talk to me and say that they were not very sexual. They just simply were not sexual people. And then they would get another partner, and then that would magically change. And it wasn't just, you know, partner's performance. A lot of it was just mental barriers that they had, you know, problems that they had in the relationship. Whereas, you know, men just simply don't have the same mental barriers that women do. I mean, I think a lot of women cannot have sex with their partner if they're not feeling close, or if they're feeling rejected, or if they're, and I think a lot of men don't have that issues, right? Like, a lot of men can't have sex with their partner even if they're not in the best place in the relationship. Whereas a lot of times women will be more withdrawn. So I think that for all of those reasons, yes, MDMA is going to create that closeness more than anything else.
Well, and it's kind of interesting too, when you talk about that. Like, I feel that from a biological level, like, we're all just talking monkeys. I think it's safe to say that. Yeah. And you know what I mean? And we were descendants of mammalians. You know, we were, our last common ancestor with chimpanzees was like 80 million years ago, right? Like, we share this sort of this human condition with them. And that fundamentally, like, you look at the animal kingdom with mammals, and that, you know, the male species of said group have a tendency to you know, dance, show off. They, you know, like, I mean, like, they're always looking for sex, whereas the females of said groups have a tendency to be more selective and picking and choosing to pass along these genetic traits. And I feel like that kind of that same thing happens within, you know, the human species, obviously, is that men just constantly have this overarching desire to procreate, which is transferred to sexual arousal, whereas for women, I think it is significantly difficult, you know, because now we've sort of advanced from the idea of you physically represent, but also you have to emotionally represent a potential mate. And I think that's a very difficult thing to translate from a psychological perspective. Like, you know, if everything was just based on physical appearance and, like, you know, you're strong, you physically fit the requirements. And I think that occurs a lot in the animal kingdom. But from a psychological perspective for humans, you're also having to match on this, you know, emotional capacity with it to choose a mate. And I think that that sort of has a significant impact in female sexuality. You know what I mean? Like, there's always this expectation too, is that, you know, you graduate high school, you marry your high school sweetheart, and you have a kid, and it's like, well, stuck in a loveless marriage kind of concept. You know what I mean? Like, I think there's a lot that flows into this from a psychological perspective.
Absolutely. And I mean, if you think about it this way, unless, especially in the animal kingdom, so once they procreate, they get to leave and the female would then get stuck raising.
Good luck.
You want to make sure that you're somewhat selective there. And interestingly enough, in the animal kingdom, I recently saw something. We typically think of birds and the dance. You know, fish actually do this too. There are certain species of fish that the male fish will, like, pick up sand and build the largest sand hill that he can. And then the female fish gets impressed and, like, hangs around the male. And I know that a lot of times that's not, like, mating in the fish world, but that's why she'll go ahead and pick him, because he was able to make the biggest little sand.
Well, I think, like, Siamese fighting fish do the same thing, but they blow bubbles that are encapsulated with, like, some sort of surfactant that, you know what I mean? Yeah. And, like, you're showing off your prowess.
Exactly. So, well, and it's interesting because I'm wondering, I think at some level, women can do that at some level as well, depending on your scenario. Like, if you look at South Florida, the way women are and just overly dressed, and, like, we're kind of doing the same thing. But, you know, it is important too, because obviously there's such a biological component, but it is important. And I do want to address, because a lot of times there are women with really high sex drives, and all too often we look at it as the men are only out there to procreate. And so sometimes in the reverse, so we're typically trying to deal with sexual dysfunctions with women here, but I have also seen and heard sometimes with women, if you are the one with the higher sex drive, then you feel, you know, less than, like, what is wrong with me? My guy doesn't want to sleep with me all the time. Or am I not attractive enough? Or with guys, it's just kind of like a high five. I had a high sex drive. I had a lot of partners. But with women, it might be stigmatized simply even just having a sex drive or even having that desire. So it is also important to kind of open that up. And that is also a thing too.
Well, and I feel like part of the problem is, like, what you're doing with NTM, I think, is extremely important as providing a mechanism in which people can work through these traumas. But again, it comes down to a massive societal change, which I'm not even sure if Western culture is prepared for a shift in this direction, because it seems like we start making these moves, like, even in Canada, you know, we had this incredible sex ed program that a handful of people with potentially a right leaning got very offended that anal sex was something that was spoken of in these programs. And then the whole thing sort of got stripped back. And now we're going back to these, what I perceive as sort of archaic, you know, educational platforms. And, like, how do you think that people move forward as a society? Like, it's,
well, I mean, that's, we want to transform the old stigmas regarding sex in general, and especially sex and psychedelics. I mean, what is more stigmatized than sex and drugs, right? We're combining them. So
throw some rock and roll in there, and it's, you know, I mean, like, it's,
no, exactly. It'd be
the 60s all over. Exactly.
But I mean, hopefully we're going to transform these old stigmas. But and really just explaining, this is really based on lack of education, as you said. Largely the war on drugs that started in the 80s. I mean, that was a large thing. The porn industry, I think that people are looking at that with too negative of a light as well. And obviously there is a dark side of the porn industry, which is, you know, something there. But the reality is that can be healing and beneficial as well. So,
sorry to interrupt you, but I'm just actually, now that you've brought up porn, I am super curious to hear your opinion on that. Because you said it's not necessarily negative from that perspective, because it really seems like people perpetuating this idea that pornography is destroying our country, just destroying the minds of the youth and whatever else.
No, not at all. So I don't see it as negative at all. I mean, I do think that if you are significantly younger and you grew up, I mean, like, porn wasn't as accessible when I grew up because the internet wasn't on everybody's phone. But like, if people are growing up and they think that all sex is like that, I think you're just going to be really disappointed when you're like, right. you're 17 and you get in the bedroom with another virgin. You're like, wait a minute.
What do we do here?
Right. Like, but I mean, I think it can be perfectly healthy. I mean, I know that there are some couples that watch it together and see that as completely fine. I know that other couples are against it. I think just like anything else, if it's something that you're really hiding from your partner, then that becomes a problem. And I do, but I mean, the same point, if one person has a higher sex drive, like I wouldn't see it as an issue. Like, as long as I get first dibs in there, if I'm not in the mood, then go do it, whatever. like I just don't see it as a big thing whatsoever. But you know, I'm obviously a little bit more open about it. And I mean, I've known people that are in the industry. I'm friends with people that are in the industry who are very, very bright, successful women. I mean, I spent 10 years in school and they're making a lot more than I am. So I don't see and she wasn't somebody that had a history of sexual trauma and it wasn't anything like that. It's, you know, and not to say that a lot of those girls haven't, because I do know that is true, but she's a sexual person and she has fun and she's made a lot of money in her life doing it. And I simply don't see anything wrong with it. But you know, as long as the person, she's very beautiful, she's and was with a good group. I do think that there are people that are simply taken advantage of, and there is definitely a dark side of, you know, illicit porn that's out there that, where somebody is taken advantage of, and those types of things are horrible. And, you know, they don't help people that are attracted to, you know, a woman in pain or, you know, dying and not the types of things where it is, you know, a planned S&M type thing where it's consensual, you know, because that's one thing if it's just fantasy, but there are some pornographies that are, you know, a girl that's just really drunk at a party that's not consenting to it. And so obviously that's not okay.
Yeah. Cause like, I think porn, again, I don't see anything wrong with it in the slightest. I think it's just an expression of our sexuality, but I do see these issues too, where now, like, you know, you go on Pornhub and every other one is some weird choke porn and degradation. And I seem like that's becoming very significant. Do you think in an absence of sexual education that, you know, children and teenagers and so forth will go to porn sites like Pornhub to try and learn about sex, and that develop this really bizarre semi-fetishized idea of what sexuality is? And I see so much degradation, and it's, you know, it's weird, like choke porn and all this bizarre stuff. And I'm like, I don't know, like, it's almost as if you're teaching this very strange, bizarre sexual acumen to children who unfortunately have been denied access to what sexuality actually is. And it creates sort of a perverted state of something that is beautiful. It's natural. It's necessary for life on this planet. You know what I mean? Like, it's, and that's kind of one of the concern I see, is that it seems like everything's going to extremes these days. You know,
well, yeah. I definitely saw that, like, in COVID. So my problem actually isn't with the, like, choke porn one as much, because you can tell if it's created in a studio or not, right? So like, you can just tell. There's lighting. Sorry, like, you know, we're not just walking around in knee-high, like, shiny leather boots all day. Like, this is just not the thing. Like,
Jason does, and he looks wonderful. So
they're phenomenal for my calves.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Like, oh my God, everything just matches, and I'm always looking perfect and perfectly made up. Like, you can tell by lighting. You can tell by all of those. Like I said, I'm more disturbed by the, you know, cell phone camera stuff that gets leaked out there. So that one I don't find as much, but there is this weird, like, you know, kind of incestuous thing that is like going everywhere in porn lately.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know where that came from. So, and obviously, you know, it's like, not, I'm like, yeah, this is the same girl I've seen in 30 other ones. Like, this is not it. Yeah. But that kind of stuff I don't really think is great to glorify. But I mean, yeah, if you don't know what you're doing, and people are always curious, right? In my day, Cosmo was the magazine, like, how do you kiss a guy? Or I think they even had, like, how do you perform oral sex in there? Whereas now, why are you going to read a magazine? You just, like, click on your phone and could YouTube, you know, the best ways to do this. And so obviously that's out there. It's just so much easier. But I don't see a problem with it. And I will say that people who, interestingly enough, people who are very religious report higher rates of porn addiction. But it's not necessarily the religion that makes them more addicted to porn. It makes them believe that they are then addicted to it. So if somebody watches porn once a day, every day, and they are not religious, they might say, I watch porn every day. Yeah, who cares?
That's nothing.
Right? Yeah, right. Yeah. Who cares? But if somebody thinks that every day is an addiction, right? And if you could think about like, okay, you desire it, you want it, then it's an addiction because you are taught that it's wrong. Which of course, for most of us, when we're taught something's wrong, what's the first thing we do? Like, oh, let's look at that. Right. So, but yeah, interestingly enough, that people who are religious are more likely to define themselves as addicted to porn. And those are also typically the people that then go crazy against porn.
Not to circle back and beat this to death, but do you think potentially kind of like along the same vein as what Adam's talking about? Because I do kind of see a place for fetish porn for people that maybe might not be able to act these things out in real world. It gives them, you know, a safe place to kind of view whatever it is
vicariously
that tickles their fancy, right? Yeah. But would you not agree that much like the media we consume day to day and the movies and things like that, like look at how male physiques and female physiques have changed throughout the decades as a result of movies and actors and kind of those perceptions. If we don't have a safe way of looking at our own bodies with respect to that, if your only way of viewing sexuality and human sexuality in an intimate way is through pornography and the pornography gets more violent or degrading, that now sets a societal norm kind of behind the scenes, and we have some of these issues that we're running into with the way men are interacting
well
with
and
women.
I think that plays into the idea is that do people affect culture, or does culture affect people? You know what I mean? What sets the trend? And I know that's sort of one of those chicken egg like scenarios, but it kind of, yeah, I know what Jason's saying.
Well, I think it's, there's obviously, yeah, I completely believe the relationship's cyclical there. So I do think that people can watch a fetishized porn and not want that in their real life. Right.
Right.
So, a lot of times when people are watching porn, one of the most searched things is group sex, whereas most women actually wouldn't want to go have sex with five guys at one time. Right. Not that there's anything wrong with that, if that's your thing, but most women really wouldn't want that. They'd feel taken advantage of. That's not their thing, but they might watch that pornography. And so I think in some ways that's good to let that out. However, there are some ones I know specifically, I know we're kind of derailing, but I know specifically like with pedophilia, when people would watch child porn, it didn't alleviate it. It actually just enhanced it. So it enhanced their desire to do it. So I don't know how and where that line is with fetishes. And so obviously if it is something like, you know, a group with, you know, a girl with five guys, there's nothing really wrong with that. So if that increases her desire to do that, then there's nothing wrong with that. But if you're fetishizing something that's really, really harmful to somebody else, then I can see where that could be a slippery slope.
It's pretty reasonable. So out of curiosity, so say one of our listeners is just curious about the ideas of female sexuality and wants to move forward in some capacity to deal with this. Like, what avenues right now exist for someone to pursue this?
So for someone to pursue what exactly? So you're talking about medications or?
Just in general, right? Like the idea of, okay, so right now MDMA is not available, obviously, because it's illegal. MAPS is moving to have it sort of pursued through the FDA for acceptance, which probably would happen based primarily on the discussion before about it being associated with the military, and that sort of invokes this sense of patriotism. So like, is there any resources necessarily available for women, like anything at all that they could be actually looking into to sort of alleviate this, and at a risk for any form of giving bad advice, like is microdosing on psilocybin effective for this kind of thing? Is microdosing on anything? Like,
it depends completely on the person. And unfortunately there's not a lot of research on combining microdosing and sexual behavior because we can't really do a lot of it. So unfortunately that's where it is. So, the biggest thing honestly is, you know, obviously everyone can talk to a sexual therapist, but really finding the root of it. And, you know, I'm not even saying that MDMA or psychedelics are necessarily the first line, of treatment when you're looking at a sexual dysfunction. I'm not advocating that, right? So if somebody ended up gaining a ton of weight, and particularly men, and you know, testosterone levels are down, or you feel self-conscious, or there's something hormonal off, then maybe that's your solution. So I would say that for somebody who's here, I would be looking at overall hormonal levels. Like if you could look at, you could do a blood test and see, like prolactin, dopamine, things of that nature. So like dopamine obviously makes you want to have more and more and more sex. Prolactin is going to say, yay, I'm satisfied. And you could actually test your levels. You can look at it. There are things you can do to change there. Always diet and exercise. And there are legal mushrooms. They do not contain psilocybin, but you can purchase them. I have, I just like them actually because, they have those and, some types of like legal, gummies because A, obviously as somebody that is a professional, taking anything illegal, is going to be a problem with my job. So I'm not going to risk that. But the other thing is it's, you know, it causes, I know a lot of people drink less alcohol when they combine, these medications. And so you can get the same effect, as the legal, psychedelics on sexual functioning, I have not seen anything on that. Not to say that it's not out there, but I have not seen the stuff that is legal here. I mean, it's pretty mild. It's pretty tame. So I wouldn't be able to accurately say, you know, this would be an intro to start. Clearly there's no harm in it. You know, it's not going to cause any health problems and it's legal and it's there, but I don't know the research on the substances that are out there now and how they can help.
Sorry, what mushrooms were you talking about when you said that you're ordering them now? Like lion's mane, reishi, chaga kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was like, I don't know if I should be like, I'll plug another company, but like, I know Silo Mart has all of those in there and they have a variety of them. So,
I guess kind of as an addendum to Adam's question, because your background is in sports, medicine, nutrition, supplementation, that sort of thing. Are there any, besides therapy, any supplements that might be effective in helping with women who are suffering from sexual dysfunction or lower libido? Jeez.
I know you mentioned version of
yeah,
that.
I know libido. just because I know you mentioned like maca root and I know there's a couple like holistic type supplements that can be bought over the counter for these sorts of things, but are any of them effective?
Not really.
No, is the short answer. There you go.
Fair enough.
You're screwed, ladies out there. There's nothing you can do. No, not really. I mean, that's honestly where it is. There are a couple things that have been found with men that, again, aren't harmful. Like yohimbine is another one. Mm. It's also kind of like a stimulant, and that can help a little bit. There's actually something called horny goat weed, true story. And again, all these are really mildly effective, if at all. The biggest thing I would say, testosterone, women have testosterone. People don't think about it as much. And testosterone is really what drives libido. And so there are things that testosterone needs in your body, like vitamin D. And we are like almost everybody's vitamin D deficient. So there's little things like that you can test in a blood test. But if you're supplementing vitamin D and lifting weights, I would say that the easiest, the one that science can back up is having those testosterone levels increase. So that would be things like working large muscle groups, squats, things of that nature. Obviously, if you're heavily dieting, or if females are heavily dieting, having really low fat, that's going to mess with vitamin D is a fat soluble vitamin. It's going to affect your body in that way. So you need to make sure that you have enough dietary fat, not too much. Most people have enough, dietary fat, vitamin D, and are lifting weights. And I think that's going to be more effective than for women, most of these supplements that are out there. For men, there are a wide variety of supplements that can be beneficial. And also on that note, there has been no clinical studies on food affecting sex drive. Everyone goes crazy with like
no oysters, eh?
Oysters.
Spanish. Oh my God.
I don't know. I found red wine to be fairly effective.
Booze in general. I don't know. Yeah. Well, reduced inhibition.
Alcohol lubes up everybody, but in the short term. But if you're a heavy drinker, then it does the opposite. But it is true, like oysters. So oysters do have zinc, and if you're zinc deficient, then it can help you. Hmm. But if you're having enough zinc in your, I mean, you can take an oyster or a zinc supplement is going to be the same, right? And zinc really actually has more to do with like sperm motility than it actually does overall sex drive. So a lot of things that are out there really, there just aren't clinical trials to back it up. It's people trying to make money and it's easier because nobody else is doing the placebo effect, right? If I take an aspirin every day and I say, yay, this is really helping my sex drive because I think it is. Well, okay. Then They're going to tell their friends this pill helped their sex drive. But the clinical trials just really aren't there.
Well, and I think the biggest take-home message of all of this is, again, people in Western society look for fix me. They look externally for some sort of mechanism to fix their problems. But at the end of the day, like, you know, again, like exercise, healthy lifestyle, appropriate diet, you know what I mean? Go see a therapist and stuff. And I would imagine that, you know, Intium itself is usually for people who have sort of exhausted this and are getting to this point where it's something needs to be done because of deep psychological trauma, I would imagine.
Yeah. And Intium, the real focus on Intium is, yes, it can be for an individual, but it's really couples. It's having that intimacy within the couples and having them engage and being open and pair bonding, all of those things. I did want to comment, though. We were talking about looking for just a pill as opposed to looking within. They were talking about antidepressants. People would be willing to take a pill to be happy, but if you walk 10 minutes a day, it was showing that they were having the same benefits. So if you told somebody to walk 5 minutes to pick up a pill and walk 5 minutes back, they would do it, but just because they wanted the pill as opposed to actually walking that 10 minutes a day.
Well, it says a lot about us as a, you know, as a society in that capacity that, again, we're just sort of manipulated or culturally brought to this place where it's always fix me. I want to sit in my home. I want to order food to my house. I don't want to leave. I want to work from home. I want everything to come to me, and I don't actually want to do anything for it. And it's sort of an interesting concept. And so one other thing too is, like, you know, so Intium, people are investing into it right now. And, you know, like, so why should people invest into it? Like, you know, you've talked about it. I think it's fantastic. But, like, what's sort of your pitch on let's put money into Intium?
Well, I mean, the biggest thing is, again, there's a patent on the ingredients, so I can't really talk.
Yeah, it's a thing that does stuff.
Yeah, it's really hard for me to really give you all the answers right now. But I can say this. The additional pharmaceutical ingredient has been found to, there are sometimes that people have concerns about the possible neurotoxicity of MDMA.
Yeah.
The additional ingredient has been found to completely get rid of them, cancel them out to a large degree at this point. So that is another benefit there. And there is a patent on this, patent pending on this. So having these two ingredients combined, obviously, we're not going to be, I believe there's one other person that's really looking at MDMA, but she might be going a different route. MDMA in terms of couples and sexual wellness. So there really isn't a ton of people out there that are looking at specifically MDMA, this extra, the other couple of ingredients that are with it, and then couples. So it is really a revolutionary idea. And I think the other great thing is that caught up in what I could say. There are other avenues with the company that we're doing more than just pharmaceutical. They're really willing to pivot in whatever way we can in order to get FDA approval, whether it is, you know, preparing for sessions with a therapist or microdosing at home. Now's the time to get in with the company, but we're really just needing to see what way we need to move once the FDA and other governing bodies come down.
And so let's just say hypothetically, and I'm hoping that this is a reality, is that the FDA sort of is working with you guys. They're allowing you to create something which you think is, which is basically your platform. Now, would you guys expand? Like, obviously you're going to leave the greater Florida area. You know, do you plan on the global takeover of sexual couples therapy with MDMA? Like, are you guys going to move to Canada? Like, is there plans for sort of this expansion or franchise variation of that?
Yes, there is. The founder is actually from Europe, from Sweden. And so Europe has been a little more progressive as well. I think Canada will be kind of the closest next bet. So it might not even be in terms of expanding. It might start off only out there in Europe and Canada. And then probably coming back. But at this point, it's hard to know. But I know that there's a lot of ties with Europe right now.
So are you guys working for sort of EU approval on that? Or is there any movement towards that?
Yeah, the founder is.
Okay, so you guys are actively also moving towards EU approval for all this, which you probably get a lot faster than FDA.
Yeah, so that is where he is looking. And he is worked with other drug companies in Europe. So that's his avenue.
That's actually really cool because that would most likely happen a lot sooner is having EU started in the EU, work within France. They seem fairly open to sexuality. Well, really, yeah. All of Europe has a very lovely attitude towards sexuality as opposed to, you know.
Eastern Europe.
Oh, Eastern Europe, is that your idea about that?
Well, that's true.
Former Eastern Bloc countries, yeah. That's where we're going to put all of our eggs. Yeah.
Just kidding.
Hey, it's nice and cold there. There's nothing else to do. We might as well just,
seriously,
you know,
right?
Yeah. And help sexual functioning when it's dark, you know, whatever, 18 hours a day and you're miserable.
Yeah, you got to do something.
Exactly.
Well, I got to say, I really enjoyed this conversation. And, you know, I listened to you speak in Miami. I was super impressed with what you were saying, your perspective on this, and even just the idea that we're so sexually suppressed in this country. And I don't think people realize how sexually suppressed we are because we acclimatized everything, right? You know, it's just been something that's been going on for so long. And I'm just happy that you're doing the work that you're doing. And I really hope that NTM basically is able to establish the platform they want in North America. And even if it's just Europe, good for Europeans at the end of the day, you know what I mean? And at the end of the day, again, like if something is shown to help dramatically the level of sexual trauma that we experience and improve couples' sex life and the betterment of the couples themselves, because let's be realistic, if the sex life deteriorates, the entire relationship has a tendency to follow suit. Then, yeah, I think this would be a fantastic mechanism in which to change that. And I think what you're doing is awesome.
Oh, wonderful. Well, thank you so much. I loved it. It was lots of fun.
And before we let you go, Dr. Leah, always like to ask our guests because Adam always forgets. Any plugs you would like to plug right now or pluggables? Books you're working on, websites you'd like to direct our listeners to? Anything of that nature?
Well, I would say Sex Talk with Dr. Leah. It is on the Health Channel app. You can download it. It is it's only in Florida right now, so it is not a national show. But anything Sex Talk with Dr. Leah on All Health Go TV, it is an app there. And so I answer a lot of very strange and fun questions on the show.
Well, actually, I listened to a couple episodes. It's really cool. I thought it was funny. It was engaging. It was super pleasant. I thought it was awesome. And NTM, what's the webpage for NTM? Is that just www.ntm.com?
So it's got ntm.co. So let me...
.co?
Yeah. That's how he had it. You know, it's funny because it's just saved in all of mine. Yep. There we go. .co. So ntiem.co.
Awesome. And yeah, so for our viewers out there, take a look at the webpage. It's actually quite cool and it's got a lot of interesting information on it.
We'll make sure to link it in the show notes.
Yeah. And again, I always forget to say this, but yeah, check out our Instagram and Twitter page and like them. Please like and subscribe where you download your podcast because I'm totally oblivious to that. So again, thank you for your time. I appreciate that. And I will talk to you later.
Thank you so much. You have a good one.
You too.